Okay. And I'm just waiting for the, there's the brown. It's been a long time, but I'm back on the road again. This is Paul Rodell. Today is the 3rd of January, a new year, 1997. And I'm in New York City in the home of Bill Serile. Do you prefer Bill or William?
Either.
Okay. Because you signed William and I wasn't sure. Who was in Vietnam a short period of time, 1967, in about October, going through what, April?
April 68.
April 68. So a very quick experience and quite obviously cut short because of the Tet Offensive. You were teaching English and in Canto, if I pronounce it correctly.
Canto.
Yeah, or at least close enough. And that should be enough of the intro for the first part of the transcription later. What I said just before starting the tape is that we didn't have enough room on a form like this for all kinds of background questions, and we were interested in every volunteer, no matter what country served or when, in their motivations to why they joined and a bit about their own birth, upbringing, parenting, education, etc., that created them as individuals who were eventually pointed in a volunteer direction. So I'll ask you to just simply tell me what your own background is, you know, allowing you to figure out the high points, you know, starting from birth and all that.
Well, I was born in 1941 in New Orleans, Louisiana, but my parents moved to Seattle during the World War II. So I was raised in Seattle and went to high school and college in that area. I left Seattle in 1963 to join the Peace Corps in Ethiopia. And what motivated me to go into the Peace Corps was the 1962 World's Fair.
Really?
Which was held in Seattle.
Oh, okay.
I went with my parents to see it, and they had a very small room, probably no larger than a typical home living room, Peace Corps exhibit. None but photographs of volunteers at work. And something inspired me and said, I'm going to join the Peace Corps.
And this was in 62?
That was September of 62.
Okay, and so you're 19 years old. Or is my math wrong?
No, I was 21.
21, okay, I'm flipping it around.
And I decided I was gonna, I must have a postcard or some information about the Peace Corps. So I applied to the Peace Corps.
Uh-huh.
And I got accepted in the spring of 63 to go to Ethiopia. And that to a large degree changed my life because it allowed me to have cross-cultural experiences, to travel and to see the world in the United States from different perspectives.
Yeah. Well, what was it about that the World's Fair and the Peace Corps booth that grabbed you?
I don't know. Maybe if I saw it today, it wouldn't have the same reaction.
Yeah.
It's just something about people at work and volunteers and in different cultures. And I think maybe to a degree what motivated me also was I was in a typical collegiate situation, going to school, studying to be a teacher.
Yeah.
And I remember at that time I didn't want to have the ordinary life. I didn't want to get married at 23 and have a mortgage and have kids at 24 and live that ordinary life. So I think to some degree it was the excitement of maybe escapism. Opportunity to leave and to do things that I'd never done before, never even thought about before.
Yeah, I think that's a good time for being very vulnerable to those kinds of impulses.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, you kind of like yearn for the family and for the settled life, but for a while there, it's really. So, where'd you go to school?
Went to the Central Washington State University in a very small town called Ellensburg. It's a town about 110 miles east of Seattle.
Wow, so it's kind of like in the middle of the...
It was middle of cow country and apple trees, and we only had 2,000 students.
Yeah. Yeah, because I know about schools on either side, you know, both in Seattle and then on the other side of the state, but I hadn't really heard of that place. What were your parents doing that they, your dad moved out to Seattle?
My dad moved to a place called Bremerton, which is right across the water from Seattle in 1943, to work in the naval yard.
I was wondering if it was war related, yeah.
And we followed, I was 2 years old at the time, and we followed sometime in 1943.
Uh-huh.
And it was, on his part, really an economic, temporary move, but
mm-hmm.
Once the war ended, he decided that it'd be better for the family to stay up north and go back to New Orleans. So that's where I was raised.
Yeah, yeah. So he was, what, a shipyard
well,
worker?
Well, I was just temporary. His profession was a garment worker. He was what they call mm-hmm. a cutter.
Okay.
Which was a skilled position where you have large bolts of cloth and you have to cut through them, cut out patterns for coats. So he did that until he retired.
Oh, wow. And your mom?
She's we call a homemaker, stayed mm-hmm. at home, mm-hmm. took mm-hmm. care of the kids, raised a family, and took care of the house.
How many brothers, sisters?
The family, there were seven altogether. Mm-hmm. Five boys and two girls.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And we ranged, this big age difference. It's 17 years from the first to the last.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I had brothers who had traveled. I had two brothers who were merchant seamen. And they had older brothers. One was 12 years older and one was 10.
Uh-huh.
And they had traveled. And another brother was 7 years older who was in the Air Force. But I wasn't like really curious about places that they visited. I mean, certainly they would come home and say, well, I was in
Germany
or North Africa or someplace. Mm-hmm. But because of the age differences, I wasn't really excited about their travels.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't the reason that motivated me to go into the Peace Corps. It was simply just seeing that exhibit.
Yeah, really. Yeah, I know that was certainly the trigger. I was wondering if there might be other things ruminating in the background, because that wasn't too long after Kennedy's speech, you know, the inaugural and the whole excitement about the launching of the Peace Corps that got so many people's attention.
Yeah, I don't think anything to do with Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I recall him saying something about the Peace Corps,
yeah.
But it didn't grab me at that point. And if I had not seen the exhibit, I may not have even selected the Peace Corps.
Right. Normally, at this point, I'd also ask about the religious background, because so many people in IVS were that, but of course you had done Peace Corps instead first.
Yeah.
So that wasn't necessarily you know, it wasn't like you were a Quaker, or Brethren, or
Mennonite,
or something like that.
IVS is totally different.
Yeah, very, very different. What did you do, just very briefly, in Ethiopia? Was it also English teaching?
I taught in English, but I taught world history, European history, and geography,
mm-hmm.
on high school level,
uh-huh.
for 2 years.
And was that... How would you describe that experience, the Peace Corps experience?
Well, it was a major experience in my life, because it gave me an opportunity to live in a different culture,
mm-hmm.
and to have that experience. And particularly being in Africa at that time was very exciting, because all around me was independence movements, particularly in the British colonies. And keep in mind, at that time, they didn't have anything like Black Studies, African Studies on the average college campus.
Yeah.
So I knew nothing about Africa except a lot of stereotypes. And these stereotypes were dispelled.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was very exciting to be in Africa, to see Africans, airline pilots and bank tellers, and doing things that most Black people in America didn't have the opportunities
mm-hmm.
in the early 60s to even experience.
Yeah.
And then, too, to see some of the ancient ruins in Ethiopia and to know that, yes, they had a culture and they had
mm-hmm.
a history. They were making contributions.
And going far back.
Yeah, and then physically, I resembled many Ethiopians, so I didn't have that kind of problems. I enjoyed working there in a very exotic, beautiful country.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, today I still keep in touch with Ethiopia, through people I meet here. There are a lot of Ethiopians in New York City, and I know some, and
mm-hmm.
I'm always curious about what's going on in that part of the world.
Still keep in touch with anyone you worked with there?
Not there, no. Mainly because of, you know, all the conflicts they've had, you know, the wars, because yeah. The area where I was teaching in Tigray province was one of the areas under rebellion.
Oh.
And, you know, they have fighting in the city that I worked in.
Uh-huh.
But I've met Ethiopians here in New York and throughout the country. And
yeah.
Anytime I meet them, I'm always happy, you know, to talk to them.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
About Ethiopia.
Get some news. And
you know, news and just to share, you know, some experiences. For example, one of my colleagues who's an adjunct in my college came from the same town that I lived in.
Oh, wow.
So he goes back every few years, so he tells me about the latest changes, which
uh-huh.
quite profound.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Well, you go from 6-hour electricity when I was there to 24-hour electricity is major. Yeah. And you go from no television to TV sets is a major transformation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me pause just for a second here, because I'm going to say something about my own Peace Corps experience that has no relevance to the IBS okay. project. Okay, I'm back. It's rolling again. Okay, so you got out of Peace Corps by when?
July 1965, and I came back and I entered graduate school at Teachers College, Plymouth University, for a master's program.
Uh-huh.
And during that period, it took me a year and a half, and just prior to graduating in the early summer of 66, I got a notice from my draft board, and the letter said to report for physical for induction.
Mm-hmm.
But also there was a second letter in the same envelope which said disregard the first letter, and that they would give me a temporary deferment.
For what? Because you were in school?
Well, I evidently informed them before that I expected to get my master's in February 67.
Uh-huh.
So they basically said you were deferred until that time.
Until that time, yeah.
So I got a job teaching in the fall of 66, I guess it was. And
while you were still going to school.
Well, my last semester in graduate school I was teaching.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fall of 66.
Yeah.
And then they gave me a full deferment.
After that. Yeah.
And so I taught for that that academic year of 66, 67.
Mm-hmm.
It was sometime in either late spring, 67. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to decide if I wanted to remain where I was teaching. I didn't particularly like the situation there. And
students or administration?
I just didn't like the students. The comparison paled. I was comparing them to Ethiopian students who had to sacrifice to walk miles to get an education.
Literally walk miles to school,
you know,
and all that stuff.
And, you know, live 5 and 6 together just to mm-hmm. accommodate themselves and to make those adjustments.
Share books.
And here you find students are very lackadaisical, and I was turned off by that attitude. Yeah. So I was thinking about what should I do now. I didn't particularly want to go back to that particular school, and I wasn't sure about my options.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime in that late spring, 67, Ivan Myers, who was in the Peace Corps with me in Ethiopia, came through New York and told me he was going to Vietnam.
You were in New York teaching?
In Westchester County. I was teaching about 15 miles from New York City.
Oh, okay.
And
I thought you might have gone to the master's program back out in Washington City.
No, it's here.
Oh, okay.
And I lived in New York since 1965.
Oh.
When I came out of Ethiopia, I came through New York and ended up staying here.
Mm-hmm.
So Ivan came through and told me he was going to go to Vietnam in a training program in the late summer of 67. He said, why don't you come with me? And I said, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to teach English. And he told me about this program, International Voluntary Services, like the Peace Corps. And at that point, I said, okay, because I really had no options. I didn't want to go back to this particular school, and I wasn't sure about my future.
Yeah, spoiled kids in Westchester County would be a big difference from Ethiopian
and
kids.
And it was almost, I guess in retrospect, it was almost like a lark. Well, yeah, I'll go to Vietnam. It's a big deal. I mean, I wasn't thinking about the war. I mean, I knew the war was going on, but I didn't think of the war in personal terms, like I'll be in danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a little surprised that at that late date I could apply because the Peace Corps process was so long. You apply, and maybe 8 months later you get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And so he told me, yeah, go ahead and apply. And he gave me the address, and I either wrote or called down there. And I don't remember the fellow's name, but someone came up who was a former IDSer.
Mm-hmm.
He came up and he interviewed me in some hotel downtown in New York City. And he asked me, you know, I guess the basic questions, and it was very informal, and in fact I thought it was a little too informal.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided, okay, I'd like to go to Vietnam. And I applied and I got accepted.
Just bing bing.
Yeah, it was just a matter of, I don't know, less than 2 months, I think.
Yeah.
I got accepted, and we had a training program in Washington, D.C. It has in this, teaching English as a second language program for about a month, I think. And we had a training program and went to Vietnam in October, 67.
You were kind of an early volunteer for Peace Corps. So it was kind of like in its early days, really.
Yeah, Peace Corps, well, when I volunteered in 63, that was, Peace Corps was in third year of operation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was in the second group that went to Ethiopia.
So you were not exactly, you know, like group one, you know, from the first out, but still early. How would you compare that early training that you had with Peace Corps when you were becoming a volunteer with the training that you had as an IVS?
Peace Corps was superior.
In what ways?
Well, Peace Corps was more holistic. They looked at the people who were going in, the fact that they represented the United States. They were more involved, I think, in the psychological evaluations.
Oh, yeah.
One thing that struck me odd about IVS was the fact that I had one interview,
mm-hmm.
and to me it was very informal. It was just,
yeah.
I
see if you're vertical and breathing.
Yeah, I didn't think the person had any in-depth concerns about me as a person, my motivations, particularly in a war area. You know, why would I want to go to an area that was under a military conflict? There's no questions of that nature. And what struck me as odd was in my group there was a woman whose husband was killed in Vietnam. He was a military person, and she was only married maybe less than 6 months.
They let her in?
Yeah, and it was one of those things where they got married, when they got married, I think he was in the service when they got married,
yeah.
And maybe they only together maybe a week or a month, very short time period, and he went to Vietnam, and he was killed almost immediately, and they let her in, and I'm saying to myself, why did they send this woman to Vietnam?
Mm-mm.
To me, that was psychologically.
Send her to Iran, send her to Algeria,
yeah, I said,
send her
to
Bolivia.
Vietnam. I mean, I can understand her motivation. She wanted to go to the country where her husband lost his life, but
yeah.
I couldn't understand why they wanted to send her there, and that could brought up all kinds of problems for her.
Oh, yeah.
So there, that, to me, that was a very lackadaisical approach in the testing.
As opposed to what Peace Corps would do.
Yeah, the Peace Corps. At Peace Corps at that time, we're telling some people you can't go because we don't think that you're psychologically fit. I mean, we think that you have a mental breakdown or things.
Deselected.
Yeah, you're deselected.
Yeah.
And there are several people in my group who came very close to being deselected because Peace Corps wasn't quite sure how to judge them mentally.
Yeah, I know. That was still operative that way in 68. Yeah.
And that was, to me, that was a major, one of the major contrasts between the two organizations.
Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten about that. But we actually had, I was in a group with 117 people, and we had four shrinks.
Mm.
Well, three shrinks who were working with us and interviewing us, not constantly, but frequently, and another one who was off doing some other things.
But we also had, in my training program, we spent a weekend at Santa Barbara. We were training in UCLA and Santa Barbara for a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot
This is with Peace Corps.
Peace Corps.
Yeah.
We did a lot of it's called like psychological role playing.
Yeah.
And they told us it was experimental, that they wouldn't use it.
Oh, they did.
They wouldn't use it in the selection process for us, but they would experiment and see how people would respond. And basically what it was like peer pressure, and if you didn't like somebody, here's the time to tell them. And
sensitivity group.
Sensitivity
kind of,
training.
Yeah.
And people were breaking down and crying and so on. And I don't know if they said they weren't using it to evaluate people, they were just for experimental testing to see if it should be applied for future training programs. But IBS had none of that. I think IBS mainly was, well, you want to go to Vietnam? Okay, fine, you should take it.
You got some kind of skill. So how long was the training thing when you were going through?
It wasn't that long. I don't remember exactly when we started. I would think it was approximately a month.
That long?
No more than 1 month. We went to Washington, D.C., and I know we spent a few days at Harper's Ferry, some kind of orientation program. And then we had the English as Second Language program.
Okay.
And that wasn't very long either, I think maybe a week. So it might have been short, it might have been like maybe 2 weeks.
Okay.
It wasn't a very long program.
Yeah, and I don't think that they ever got into any long programs.
And then involving language. We didn't have any language training until we got to Vietnam.
And how was that done?
Well, when I arrived in Vietnam, they sent me to a place called Phang Rang.
Okay.
That was on the South China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a language instructor, and I think I was supposed to be there like 6 weeks. And I stayed less, maybe about two or two and a half, because someone had resigned, one of the teachers resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent me down to Canto to as replacement.
Mm.
But even while I was there, I wasn't teaching very much. I was almost like a college professor. I was like 9 hours a week type thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I had a language instructor who was a university student.
Who was kind of coaching you and things.
Yeah,
like that.
I had that book, which I think was put out by the Department of State on Vietnamese language instruction. So I had a language instructor who came by, I think it was close to 4 or 5 days a week, and we was maybe doing an hour or so with Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was teaching English in the high school there. I was only American in the high school teaching English.
Yeah, would you use Vietnamese when you were doing the English instruction?
No, because I was teaching English, and I used the Vietnamese outside the classroom.
Okay, so you, in the classroom, you did the intensive form of, we're not going to talk Vietnamese here, only English.
Yeah, but I think I would grade, it wasn't an introductory, I'm trying to think now. I took over this class, and so they had some English background, but I do recall that I was using sentences like, is Mr. Johnson a doctor? Yes, Mr. Johnson is a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
No, is Mr. Johnson a lawyer? No, Mr. Johnson is not a lawyer. It's on that level.
Yeah. Okay. So how proficient in Vietnamese do you think you got?
I would have been fluent if I stayed 2 years.
Okay.
At the point I was there, I couldn't understand it that well, but I could ask a lot of questions. And if I went out on the street and there was a vendor selling a sandwich, I could ask for a sandwich and ask for lettuce and onions and all the condiments in Vietnamese. And I can go to a restaurant and I could order in Vietnamese. And I
read the sign in Vietnamese about...
Yeah, the reading was the easiest part.
Okay.
And I'm sorry that I didn't have time to really learn the language, but I knew more Vietnamese than I did Amharic, I'll put it that way. In 7 months, I learned more Vietnamese than I did Amharic in 2 years.
Okay, huh.
Only because in Ethiopia, everybody spoke English if they were educated.
Yeah. Did you have any French background from school?
Just high school, but that was totally useless.
Oh, it was? There was no place
no,
to use it?
No, I didn't, high school French and, learn anything in high school. So.
Okay, so it wasn't good enough to use in the Vietnamese setting?
No.
Yeah, okay.
But I found my Vietnamese helped me when I was in Cambodia, though. So I knew enough Vietnamese. I went to Cambodia after I left Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I discovered that there are a lot of Vietnamese in Cambodia.
Yeah,
And so I could use Vietnamese to get around Cambodia.
That was traveling as kind of like a tourist after the
after April.
Yeah.
After I left Vietnam.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. In your form here somewhere, and I just remember the reading it last night and the little note I made. So I'm not going to quiz you on exactly what you said, but you made references to your teaching of English and how you weren't really.
I wasn't satisfied teaching.
Yeah.
In fact, because of the
use that was made of the
English. I was teaching English in high school, and at some point, I decided that I was serving the wrong masters. I decided that many of my students who were becoming proficient in English were leaving school and getting jobs with AID or construction companies as interpreters or translators.
Right.
And they were earning more money than Vietnamese school teachers or Vietnamese police officers.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought I was adding to that kind of corruption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the lack of value system.
Yeah.
So I recall writing to IBS in Saigon, and I didn't keep the letter, but I recall it was a very strong letter, and I expressed my sentiments on that matter, and I told them that unless they gave me a transfer, preferably working with refugees at the end of the school year, I was going to resign.
Yeah.
And when the Tet Offensive ended everything, so I never came to that point.
Never came to it, but certainly you had made a decision.
I made a decision because I just felt that I was there for the wrong purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't there to help them get employment at the expense of other people.
Right.
I just thought that if I was going to be a contributor to Vietnam, I'd be a better contributor working with people who needed help. Like refugees.
Yeah, because you certainly weren't doing anything for development per se.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. What about the Tet Offensive? Where were you, and how much of a surprise was it for you? Was there any inkling that you had?
Well, the Tet Offensive occurred on February the 1st, Vietnam time, January 31st. United States time.
Uh-huh.
I sort of knew something was going to happen because my language instructor always told me to avoid certain areas of Canto at nighttime. He said, it's okay to go there during the daytime, but he said, that's Viet Cong area, so don't go there at nighttime.
Yeah.
And I had a number of students who seemed to be pro-Viet Cong. Sometimes we get off the track and have discussions in English.
Uh-huh.
And they would say like things like Viet Cong number one, Viet Cong good, I think my language instructor told me I should buy extra food or I shouldn't be out in the streets or something around that time. And
it's not just for a holiday celebration.
No. And I think he might even suggested that something was going to occur around that time. I think he was saying, you know, the Vietnamese people were stocking up on food because something was going to happen. But the night before it happened, I went over to John Balaban's house.
Would have been on the 30th of January, or 31st their time.
31st, yeah. And went over to John Balaban's house. John lived in a hamlet in Canto, and it's a very peaceful area, and it was more traditional Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Where I live was on the equivalent of the main street, and it was very noisy, and you had a lot of American influence because maybe a quarter of a mile away there were bars and GIs would go there.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the cultural influences of the American presence. But where John lived, it was more traditional, where the children were polite, and they wanted the sarcastic kiss you would see around the GIs.
Yeah.
And I was over at John's for Tet, which is Vietnamese New Year's, and his neighbor had some traditional foods and things and drinks. And it struck me how peaceful it was because it was a truce.
Yeah.
And at that point I said, I think I'll stay here 3 years. That was my thought. I'll stay in Vietnam for 3 years instead of 2 years because I had a sense this is how Vietnam should be.
Yeah.
And without war.
And you'd like to be a part of it.
Yeah, and it was very peaceful, and I liked it. And I recall a little girl was there with firecrackers, and she slightly singed her hand with the firecracker. Yeah. And I remember holding her and, you know, like soothing her tears. And
yeah.
And then at some point I left. It was already past midnight, and mm-hmm. I couldn't find my way out. It was dark. And I was, it was like a maze, and I was walking. And I knocked on several doors, and I asked in Vietnamese, like, where was the street, where was the road? And some people were very impolite, and they closed the door in my face.
Mm.
And then I think John caught up, John found me, because I guess John got worried.
Yeah.
I can't see when it's dark anyway, but I was like trying to find my way out of this place. And John caught up to me and took me to the main street.
Uh-huh.
And then I went home, and that next morning, around about, well, actually while I was sleeping, or maybe half asleep, I heard the familiar sound of, you know, thump, 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 mm-hmm. like mortars and bombs exploding.
Yeah.
But that was typical in Vietnam. I mean, that was like background noise, like being in New York City where you hear a police siren or a fire,
right.
or ambulance siren. It's there, and you learn to hear things, and you say, as you would say any place else, if I hear a fire siren in my neighborhood, my first thought is it coming towards me? And then as I hear it going away, I say, okay, it's not my problem, and you forget
yeah.
about it. Well, the same way in Vietnam, you would hear mortars or bombs exploding 5-10 miles away, but you could tell from the sound that it wasn't close by, so why bother? And I recall hearing these noises, and it didn't strike me at that time that the truce was broken, because
it was so constant.
It was so constant, even though the truce was in effect already for a day or two.
Uh-huh.
And then next morning, around about 7 a.m, I heard this pounding on my door. And I recall saying to myself, or recall saying out loud, what the hell do you want, or who the hell are you, or something like that.
Okay, and there's the brown tape again, so we can
right,
carry
so
on.
I recall saying something like, who the hell are you? What the hell you want? I was,
yeah.
I was like tired because I stayed up until probably about 2 o'clock that morning.
Sure, yeah.
And I opened the door and there was this United States colonel. And he said, the Viet Cong came in here last night. We have them down the road a little bit, so stay in your house.
Hmm.
And I recall waking up my roommates, Jerry Kluwer and Roger Hinsey, and I told them this. And some reason, we decided to go next door because our Vietnamese landlord lived next door. Went next door, and we had some traditional Vietnamese food for holidays. And at that point, we decided we should just walk about a quarter of a mile away to visit someone whose name I can't recall, who was working with CARE.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked out, and you know, nothing seemed strange. I mean, we didn't hear any noise or anything, so it's okay. You know, war's over with, no big deal.
Yeah.
And, or the invasion's over with, no big
yeah.
deal.
A little so flare up.
Yeah, so we went over, and I recall walking over, and before I got to this guy's house, I saw a lot of people gathered around, including some Vietnamese soldiers. And I walked over, and there was a fence, some kind of a wire fence. And I recall seeing some flesh stuck to the fence.
Ooh.
And it reminded me of like the kind of thing when you clean the chicken and you're taking some of the fat or skin off
yeah,
the
yeah.
chicken. That's what it looked like. And on the ground there was a foot, a Vietnamese foot.
Whoa.
And some cloth, some green cloth.
Yeah.
And someone said that he got hit by a rocket.
Yeah.
And at that point I see people firing up into a building because some Viet Cong were in the building.
Yeah.
And then we began to realize, well, the war is here.
Yeah.
And then we went over to this fellow's house, worked with CARE, and he was up in a building that was about 3 stories high. And went up to his place. It was Jerry Kluwer and Roger Hinsey. And we had a Vietnamese worker with us. Trung was his name, I believe.
The guy who worked for IVS?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think I forgot his name right now.
Uh-huh.
I think it was Trung, but or Hip, I can't remember his name. We decided to go up on the roof of this mm-hmm. building. We went up on the roof, and we could look down, and across the way were all these little alleyways. And we saw Vietnamese soldiers running in and some running out because they're being fired upon.
Yeah.
And also, on top of this building where we were, there's some Vietnamese writings, and our Vietnamese friend told us it said something about the war. And I forgot what he said. But then people start shooting at us. Mm-hmm. We hear sounds like ping, ping. they're shooting at us.
Yeah.
The Viet Cong shooting at us. And it was kind of strange because you could hear the sound and you couldn't really see people. And you begin to wonder why they're doing this. And I became a little bit disillusioned. But if I go back a little bit, I really became disillusioned. I don't recall the dates now, but I would think maybe about a month before the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Kennedy came to Vietnam. He was chair of the refugee committee. And he came to Vietnam, and he wanted to talk to some IDSers about refugees, and particularly Dave Gillison,
mm-hmm.
who the Vietnamese call the poor American by the way he lived and dressed. And we went over to the IDS house that Roger Montgomery lived at, and we had taken a Jeep and a Land Rover, and the Jeep was parked in a small driveway, the Land Rover was parked right on the street, about 15 feet apart, and we got there about 5:30, and it wasn't dark yet. It got dark in Vietnam around 6 o'clock, and right outside the house was a tree, on one of the tree limbs, there was a television set, like an outdoor TV set for mm-hmm. the Vietnamese, and there were, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 people watching television. So we went in the house waiting for Senator Kennedy to show up, and there was an explosion, and we ran outside, and then someone had set an explosive beneath the Jeep, but it wasn't a very large one. And Roger Hinsey...
Which of the two Jeeps, the one on the street or the one in
the driveway? The one in the driveway.
Okay.
And when I say in the driveway, it was maybe 10 feet from the door, front door of the house. Ooh. It wasn't very far. And we came out, and there were Vietnamese screaming and running around and hysterical. And evidently, we thought maybe somebody was injured. And the mm-hmm. hospital is only about two blocks away. And Roger Hinsey jumped into the Land Rover, turned the motor on, and I think someone was going to pick up the Vietnamese at that point and put them in the Land Rover. And another Vietnamese said, like, no, and because he had a flashlight. And Roger jumped out real quickly, and beneath the front right wheel was a mine.
This is the one on the street now?
Yeah, on the street. Okay. It was only parked there about 20 minutes earlier.
Wow.
And someone had dug into it to the ground, and they put a mine or explosive right there.
Could it have been there before?
No.
And you just pulled
up
close to it?
No, it wasn't there before, because you could see that it was right next to the wheel like that, and evidently the wheel had gone backwards. It had hit it, or maybe even the back wheel going forward.
Okay,
and over it.
Yeah, all right, okay.
Now, the strange part about it was someone put both explosives there mm-hmm. after we arrived with a crowd of people who were there watching television.
Nobody saw anything.
Nobody saw anything. A dog came over near that explosive, and then it went off.
Mm-hmm.
And my thoughts were, I just came in that Land Rover, and I was sitting on the passenger side where this mine was set. And if I had gotten in the vehicle, I could have had my legs blown off, because I took photographs of the thing, and the ceiling of this Land Rover was all full of holes, and the shrapnel holes, and the seat was all blown out. And at that
Roger
point,
has some of those photographs.
Yeah, yeah, I had some too. And at that point, my thoughts were, don't they know who we are?
Mm-hmm.
And don't they know that we...
we wear the white hats.
Yeah, don't they know that a lot of us are, you know, against the war? And I became a little paranoid.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why, in context, it's almost strange that on eve of Tet, I'm saying I'd like to stay 3 years, because I could see the contrast between that kind of anxiety, and here there was a truce on, and it was so calm and peaceful.
Yeah.
That to me, it was the place I wanted to be, because it was a very beautiful country. I enjoyed the people, I liked the food. I didn't have any other kinds of problems going on with me. And I really wanted to remain in Vietnam.
Yeah, in that condition.
In that condition.
Not with exploding jeeps.
But then what happened, to go back to the day of the Tet, we decided to leave the home of this care worker
mm-hmm.
to go over to the hospital. For some reason, someone said maybe we should go over there and see if they need any help, because we knew there were American Air Force doctors who were assigned to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So we went over there, and the doctors were harassed, and they said there were just too many patients for them, because they're all coming in from the countryside, all these refugees.
As well as the city itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they asked us to interpret. And I said, my Vietnamese isn't that strong enough yet. I don't understand it that well. I just speak some of it, but I don't understand it that well.
Yeah, ordering a sandwich is different from dealing with somebody who's got his guts.
So they said to me, okay, you come with us. Mm-hmm. Took me into the operating area.
Yeah.
And it said, we want you to be a scrubber. I said, what's that? He said, well, all you gotta do is go wash your hands with this antiseptic soap, put on the gown and the mask. And so they had me as a scrubber. So I spent part of that day helping with operations.
Scrubber, what do you do?
Well, the scrubber does is basically in the operating room, just prior to the operation, you have to take some antiseptic soap.
Clean off the area.
And they clean off the area
they
operate on. So they're going to, and I did that for that day. And
mm-hmm.
then I went to Saigon. When I came back from Saigon about maybe a week later, went back to the hospital. I worked there for about 3 weeks as a scrubber. So
mm-hmm.
I saw brain surgery. I saw leg amputations. I saw
mm-hmm.
intestinal surgery. And I saw everything.
Yeah.
Because the people coming in, you know, shrapnel wounds, bullet wounds, step on mines.
Yeah.
You know, all casualties of the war.
Yeah. For how long was that? Did you work there?
I did that for about 3 weeks, roughly. I mean, it didn't bother me. I mean, emotionally nor physically, it didn't bother me. You know, I saw people who were dead. And, first time I saw someone who was had rigorous mortis. A guy was in a morgue right outside the hospital and went out there to carry a body of a young child.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was sort of like on his elbow, you know, like a statue. It was just weird looking. But that's how he died, and that's how he brought him in.
Mm.
You know, rigorous mortis.
Because he'd already been stiff by the time they found him. Yeah.
And then my high school was all full of refugees, so I could see the TED vacation was, I think, a week.
Mm-hmm.
And the school was closed down from the beginning of February until sometime in April.
Mm-hmm.
It was just closed down, so I had nothing to do, so I ended up working in the hospital. I think it was 3 weeks, it might have been longer, but I know at some point the number of patients began to dwindle and didn't need my assistance. So maybe, I would say roughly, I came back after about a week. I went to Saigon for a week. So about 3 weeks in February, and I think at least another 2-3 weeks in March. So I was there about 6 weeks in the hospital.
Yeah, okay. All totaled.
Yeah, working in the hospital with the American Air Force doctors.
But at first, almost immediately after the TET, you did go to Saigon for a while.
No, what happened was the day I went to the hospital, which was the first day of the TET offensive,
mm-hmm.
We were there, and we worked there, I don't know how many hours, maybe about 3-4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then doctors were very concerned because the rumors were the Viet Cong were going to come in to kill the doctors. And at some point, some Green Beret showed up.
Mm-hmm.
Young guys, really young, like 20 years old. And I was 27 at the time. And they, I was 26, which is before my 27th birthday. And they showed up, and they had some weapons. And they had one called a grease gun.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the young guys, I can see his face right now, he had blonde hair,
mm-hmm.
little, like a beginning of a mustache, probably 20 years old. And he gave me this thing. And I knew nothing about weapons, except I recall reading somewhere, or, you know, seen in the movies, you have a little safety latch,
mm-hmm.
and the trigger won't work unless you release the safety. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking about, I may have to fire this thing. So my question to this Green Beret was, I need to know how you fire this thing. And I should have said, like, is there a safety latch or something? And I guess he thought I was just totally ignorant. He says, pull the trigger. See, I just pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
I felt so humiliated that my first instant thought was, kill this asshole.
Yes.
Just shoot him, you know. That was my thought.
Just get rid of this
guy. Just shoot him. Because I wanted him to reassure me to say, well, make sure you push this little lever, otherwise it won't fire.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or if you fire it, be sad because it's going to have a kick or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, someone's telling me the Viet Cong's all over the place, and I'm at the fire. I want to make sure I'm going to fire the thing that's going to work.
Yeah.
And the Green Beret said it wasn't safe to stay there, so we had to leave. Now, fortunately, or maybe unfortunately, we had our vehicle. It was, I think it was a Land Rover or a Jeep, I don't recall. We had it outside the hospital, about 20, 30 yards from the gate. The Green Beret had their Jeep inside the hospital compound. And John Balaban, in his book, described a scene where I think they asked the Vietnamese guard to open the gate, and he wouldn't open the gate, and they were going to shoot him. Because he was afraid Viet Cong may be right outside. But they opened the gate, and the Green Berets took off with the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to run about 20, 30 yards. And I recall I was wearing...
To get to the Jeep.
Yeah, and I was wearing like shower thongs, like sandals, flip-flop type things. I remember we were running, and somebody fell down. One of us fell down. It wasn't me. It might have been Roger Hensley. Somebody slipped. And the Vietnamese who were still back there started giggling. There was a lot of kids there, and they were all giggling until he fell down. And we jump in the vehicle, and we're driving down this main boulevard. And we hear shots at us, someone shooting at us.
Mm-hmm.
And we look around, we couldn't see them. We just hear these bullets.
Yeah,
shots.
whiz by.
So we went to the nearby base. There's an Air Force base nearby, about 5 miles from the city. And we went there. And when we got there, the rumor was Viet Cong were coming that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked them, I said, do you have any kind of plan to get out of this place? And they said, no. I said, any evacuation plans? No. I said, come on. I was in Ethiopia. I said, Peace Corps had an evacuation plan in case there was a revolution or Haile Selassie got assassinated. We had some plan to get out of the country. Nope. And they had a movie. I saw a movie there. And I don't recall the title, but it was a movie about World War II and about being courageous. I said, come on, something's going on, something's crazy here. And here you got a movie for entertainment of GIs and about World War II, about being courage in battle. and Balaban talks about this in his book, and some of the details I don't recall, which he did because he kept a journal. And the next day, I think it was, we got evacuated to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flying into Saigon is almost like a Fellini movie. We came to Saigon, and it was about dusk, around 6 o'clock. And flying to Tan Son Nhut Airport, we could see Shalong, the Chinese section of Saigon. And I could see and hear gunfire. And it's only maybe about a half a mile from the airport. And flying into the airport, we could see GIs with their shirts off playing half-court basketball. And half a mile away, there was gunfire and explosions. And over here is GIs playing basketball.
This is like Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you tell people. They say, oh, come on, you're lying. You've been smoking something. But that's the way Vietnam was. There's all these contrasts that were going on.
All this craziness.
Yeah, and I spent about 5 days or a week in Saigon. Totally forgot all my Vietnamese.
That quick?
Yeah, I had a mental block because I wasn't speaking it.
Mm-hmm.
I was basically locked up in an IVS compound, just speaking English, and I couldn't remember anything anymore.
Were they going nuts in terms of trying to count all the volunteers and make sure they had everybody? And
yeah, we began to hear rumors at that point. At that point, I began to hear that, I think that's when I heard that Gary Davis, who I knew from Ethiopia, and Mark and a young lady were captives.
Uh-huh.
I think I heard at that point there. And I do know that IBS had sent a telegram to my parents.
They did?
Yeah.
Reassuring them.
Said I was safe, and they even said I was very helpful, and I courageous and a great contributor because I worked in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
And I asked my parents about the telegram, and no one ever found it. I mean, they saw it, but they don't know what happened to it.
Yeah.
I never found the telegram to see what they actually said. But the IBSs weren't full of anxiety. I mean, once you were in Saigon, we felt safe. And
yeah.
I mean, we're in the house, and there wasn't any threat of us being overrun. And we certainly knew that the city wasn't going to be overrun, even though there were fighting in pockets of the city. But
mm-hmm.
Once we felt safe to return, I didn't know if my house was there or not. Went back to Kanto, my house was there, there was no damage to it, but I went around, I took photographs, and there's all this damage, all in Kanto, buildings being just demolished. And that's when I began to learn some of the lies of the body counts. I know they destroyed the University of Kanto,
mm-hmm.
It's only about half a mile from where I live. They destroyed the science building. In fact, I witnessed the destruction the first day I went to the hospital, the first day of TED. As we were getting ready to leave the hospital, we could see the planes coming in, or the helicopters coming in, and just see, and then boom,
mm-hmm.
and we could see the explosions. And the Stars and Stripes had some figures, I forgot the exact figures, but they say 75 bodies were found. And Vietnamese told me like they found 4 bodies. So we can just say, well, something's going on here.
Yeah,
you know,
the
body counts and everything was inflated.
I want to come back to some pre-TED stuff, but sure. First, because we're on this kind of roll, might as well continue. Come April, and you're leaving. Was that your choice? Was that IBS
no,
choice? Was that
it's
combination?
Well, what happened was I couldn't teach because the school was just full of refugees.
All right. And that was not going to change anytime soon.
That changed about sometime in April.
Uh-huh.
But about the time it was changing, IBS told all of us, well, you have a choice now. You can stay and fulfill your contract.
Yeah.
But if you decide to leave before your contract ends, you have to pay your way home. Or under the circumstances, if you want to leave now, you can leave and we'll buy your tickets.
Okay.
And at that point, I decided, well, my school is closed. I can't teach.
Yeah.
I didn't want to teach anyway.
That's right. You had already kind of said that very clearly.
And I didn't like the living arrangements anymore because Kanto had a curfew.
Mm-hmm.
They had barbed wire set up. They had these bunkers set up in town square. I got to the point where I began to realize maybe people don't know who I am. I mean, I thought everybody knew that was IBS or I was anti-war. And,
mm-hmm.
and then Dave Gillison was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, look, I had nothing to prove. I mean, it was harder. The living was harder in Ethiopia, physically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had more problems of potential bad health in Ethiopia than it was in Vietnam. Living conditions were more primitive, even though they weren't really that primitive. But in comparison, they were more primitive in Ethiopia than they were in Vietnam. So I said to myself, you know, I have nothing to prove. I mean, I proved that. I can live in another culture under different conditions. So I know the proof by staying in Vietnam.
Yeah.
So I decided to take advantage and to leave the country.
Okay.
And then the only thing that disturbed me was I had to go tell my principal. I said, I'm sorry, but you know, I'm going home. Because I was brought in as a replacement a few months earlier. And here we are in the middle of the school year. And you have to find someone to replace me. And I felt bad about that, but... That was the only regret that I had.
Well, under the circumstances, he probably understood.
Well, he did. I mean, he did, I'm sure. It's just that I didn't want to leave under those terms, though. I prefer to say I'll finish out the school year in June and then you have time to find another teacher because IBS probably sent someone to replace me or someone else.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me pause for a second here because I...
Is Roger still thin?
Here, let me pause in with Jerry, so it's back on again, but you were saying that Jerry Kluwer, who you roomed with for a while, was CIA.
Yeah, I would think about a third were, and then there were a few like myself who were ex Peace Corps volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
There was a fellow who was from Turkey, Peace mm-hmm. Corps volunteer in Turkey, and a few others, Ivan and Gary. I would think we had maybe. a dozen ex-volunteers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then I would say at least a third were COs. In fact, I remember some people there were even talking to the COs about how could they get the status, what they need to do in order to be a CO, because they were, you know, saw the war and they didn't want to be a part of the war.
Yeah.
And they were going to leave maybe in 6 months.
And then might get drafted and get sent back again.
And they're 23, 24 years old.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect time to get drafted.
Yeah, in fact, one of the volunteers was actually an ex soldier in Vietnam.
Mm.
He came back. He came back as a volunteer.
Who was that?
I don't remember his name.
Okay.
He came back as a volunteer. In fact, his brother was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We got to Saigon. He went to visit his brother the first day we arrived in Saigon. His brother was in the army.
Mm-hmm. I could see that happening quite frequently.
And that's what I heard about Dave. I think Dave was a Marine. Marine.
Yes, he was. He was formerly. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I met him. I talked to him. I can talk about that if you like.
Well, I'm somewhat curious. You know what he was
oh,
like.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes, we've been.
I met Dave Gillison in Canto, and I don't recall when it was. It was 1967, maybe around November or December.
So not long after you got there.
Right. And I was kind of arrogant because I didn't like the military police telling me what to do.
Uh-huh.
I recall I would go to the bars in the morning to speak Vietnamese with the girls.
Uh-huh.
And they were different in the morning because they were without makeup.
Yeah.
And without trying to charm GIs. And
yeah.
They were themselves. So mm-hmm. I would go in the mornings and I would just, you know, practice my Vietnamese and ask them if they'd gone to Saigon and stuff. They want to go to America and just use the language. And I recall meeting Dave. I heard of him because he was very well known in the country as a poor American because uh-huh. of the way he lived and dressed. And he, I don't think it was in the bar, I think it was in the street, and an MP stopped him and harassed him because he was wearing jeans and sandals.
Uh-huh.
And some reason they didn't like the way he was dressed. I think GIs weren't supposed to wear like open-toed sandals.
Uh-huh.
And he had socks on. And he was very, very pacifist. I mean, he was like very meek with them. And I remember telling GI MP, leave him alone. You know, nobody tells a man how he should dress. He's not a military man, you know. So don't you deal with these GIs to come to bars and get drunk and, you know, cause a scene. And that was my experience with him. So I was really shocked when I heard that he was killed. Although we all thought that he was killed by the South Vietnamese Army,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the Viet Cong. Because the Viet Cong had no rationalization to kill him. What we think happened was he knew about an airstrike, a mistaken airstrike that killed some Vietnamese civilians. And evidently he probably was going to tell Senator Kennedy about this and maybe go into some details about corruption in the South Vietnamese Army. So we think that's why he was killed.
Yeah. Silence him might have been embarrassing to many people.
Yeah. That's the reason we think, though.
Yeah. Yeah, it came quite a shock to a lot of folks. That's the reason why my partner in this project, who actually kind of invited me in, mm-hmm. got interested because he knew the Gettleson family when he was growing up.
Okay. Because there's one of the volunteers, name I can't recall, he said he wanted to write a play about Dave.
Really?
I don't know if he ever did it or not, but I remember in Saigon, during that time of the Tet Offensive, we were sitting around talking.
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of sheepish about it. He said, I want to write a play. I said, yeah, what? And he sort of sheepishly said, oh, you know about Dave Gillison. I guess he was struck by it, you know, the way he lived and the way he died.
But might be a good play.
Yeah, we were all innocents. You know, at that age, the war was there, but it's like living in New York City, you know, there's crime and there's violence, but
mm-hmm.
it doesn't affect you, so you don't think about it. And so when Dave got killed, that was a shock. And that was after that incident with the Jeep that had the explosions.
His death was after the Jeep?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that was after that time. But his death and that incident, I mean, it made me paranoid because I remember I had a motor scooter, and I used to, every day, before I got on my motor scooter, I would take off the gas cap, the flashlight, I would sort of look to see if anything was sticking out.
Oh.
If somebody had put anything in my gas cap that would cause it to explode when I hit the starter.
Wow.
You know, I got a little paranoid, you know, just because things were going on. I remember during the, once the Tet Offensive occurred, and Canto had this curfew, I was walking down the street, and all of a sudden, something happened, I forgot what happened, but I looked up, and I saw about three or four guys on the balcony with machine guns. They just popped up. And then it hit me, well, they were Vietnamese soldiers.
Yeah.
And civilian dress, or police in civilian dress, but it just struck me that they were only about 20 yards away from me, and one flight up. And they could have been Viet Cong, and I could have been caught in a crossfire. And at that point, you begin to realize, well, the war really is here. It's not 20 miles away. It's not 15 miles away. It's not a nighttime activity. It could be a daytime activity as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would kind of bring it home. Yeah, there was... sorry, I just buzzed out for a second here because I was listening to you and also trying to think of the next step.
You want to talk about race relations, or
there were some things. Partially the race relations, but also the difference. What struck me when I was reading your form was how you seem to consciously try to meet with Vietnamese more so than some of the other volunteers. You mentioned that you went to smaller restaurants.
Because
that way you wouldn't have the American military or newspaper people coming in, and you could interact more with Vietnamese.
Well, I did the same thing in Africa. I decided that I was not in America, and I didn't want to be around Americans. I had to.
Yeah.
And particularly in Vietnam, I partly was safety conscious because I always recall reading in Time magazine or occasionally in Saigon, there's a floating restaurant and there's an explosion and 20 GIs are wounded.
Yeah.
So I decided, what's the point of me going to a large restaurant
where all those guys are hanging out?
You're going to have GIs or you're going to have newspaper people hanging out, and it's a target. So by going to a small restaurant that had 8 tables, the food's going to be authentic.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to come in and throw in a hand grenade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's safer from my perspective. And plus, the food probably be a better food because it's not catered to American taste.
Right.
And I really wanted to learn the language because I regretted not learning Amharic sufficiently because I was, you know, typical Peace Corps fashion, I was in a non-Amharic speaking area, but they taught us Amharic in training.
And
because of the situation where I was teaching and everyone who was educated spoke English, my Amharic was limited, and I really wanted to become proficient in Vietnamese. And that was part of the reason why I made an effort to meet as many people as I could.
Uh-huh. It seemed to go beyond just desire to get a language or security, though.
Well, I enjoyed living there. I don't know if it's some kind of past experiences, reincarnation, or not, but I seem to have an affinity with Asians.
Uh-huh.
And being